This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. There are so few mental health resources in Bloomington Normal, people stop looking for help. Stephanie Barish with the Center for Youth and Family Solutions says when people can get help, there are waiting lists.
That sometimes is the tricky piece. Wait lists tend to go up during the school year.
Barish and others tell GLT's Mary Cullen how they're trying to help kids with mental health issues. Plus, GLT's Ryan Denham files his final piece of the week about the LA Auto Show and Rivian Automotive's launch of two vehicles. He talks with the people behind the product. Eric Stock questions Stan Nord as part of the GLT series of interviews of Normal Town Council candidates. And welcome to Splendora. Chicago-raised young man takes small-town Texas teaching job, part of a next-to-normal story slam. All that and a GLT news update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Rivian Automotive's 35-year-old founder and CEO, RJ Scaringe, knows a lot about cars. But a decade ago, when Rivian launched, he didn't know much about the auto industry. To fill in those knowledge gaps, he's surrounded himself with industry veterans with deep knowledge of American and Japanese automakers. GLT's Ryan Denham wraps up his week at the LA Auto Show by talking to these Rivian mentors about why they jumped on the Rivian bandwagon.
There's no guarantee of success in the auto industry, especially for an electric vehicle startup like Rivian. But there was a moment when John Shook from Rivian's board of directors knew they were going to make it. It was maybe 3 years ago. Shook was on the board of directors, and Rivian's founder and CEO, RJ Scaringe, had just made a prototype of a small truck with a conventional gas-powered engine.
It was an awesome prototype. We all loved it. And RJ said, this isn't the right product.
Scaringe had already pivoted once before. He started Rivian in 2009 looking to make an eco sports car, 80 to 90 miles per gallon of gas, not electric. Shook says Scaringe's willingness to walk away from that truck prototype and toward the brave new world of electric, autonomous, and connected vehicles was a big moment.
Because that was not an easy thing to do. That was not many people. I wouldn't have done that. I would not have had the guts to set that aside after we had put all that into it. And it was a wonderful little product. But it wasn't what the world was going to need in 2020.
That wasn't the last pivot point. But for each one, Scaringe has been guided by veterans of the auto industry who were attracted to his intellect, passion, and humility. GLT spoke with Shook and another Scaringe advisor, Jim Womack, on the sidelines of the LA Auto Show this week. They were in the crowd as Rivian's electric pickup and SUV pulled on stage Tuesday. Rivian now has 600 employees across the country. Most are in Plymouth, Michigan, the design and engineering hub. Others are doing self-driving and battery work in California. Around 65 are in Normal, where the vehicles will be built. Shook says Scaringe has a way of getting people to want to work with him.
Jim and I and others are old folks, don't need to go work for anyone, but I would work for RJ because he has a dream, he has his passion around it, and then the intellect as well.
Shook and Womack are both leaders of the Lean Enterprise Institute, an organization based in Cambridge, Massachusetts, dedicated to advancing lean manufacturing principles. Womack met Scaringe in 2009 when the 20-something showed up to take Womack's auto systems seminar class in the engineering school at MIT.
He came up to me after maybe the first class and said, I'm going to start a car company. Would you like to help?
Womack says he knew within 5 minutes that Scaringe was legit. He's tech-savvy, but also a people person.
I've met a gazillion MIT students, many of whom had four-digit IQs, but they didn't have a lot of other things that you need if you're actually going to make something happen. And that's okay. They can go in companies where they're one piece of the puzzle, whereas RJ was the whole protein.
They forged an uncle-nephew relationship. Womack isn't an investor, he's just an advisor. He's helped Rivian navigate three or four pivot points over the last decade. There was the eco sports car, then a little truck that was still gas-powered, then a bigger truck that was a hybrid. But Rivian's all-electric future began to take shape in 2009. That's when Uber arrived in San Francisco, changing mobility. Google launched its self-driving car project, and Tesla's Roadster EV hit the market. That's where Jim Womack comes in. He literally wrote the book back in 1991 about what automakers should learn from the lean production at Toyota in Japan. So when Rivian needed a big picture view, Womack was there to help.
So I'm out talking to a lot of people, looking at the world and what's going on out in the world. So my usefulness to RJ was not inside the company, but outside in terms of, are we doing the right thing for where we are, where the world is?
Scaringe's willingness to listen to auto industry veterans also struck Tom Gale, another member of Rivian's board of directors. He's in the Automotive Hall of Fame and was the architect of Chrysler's design resurgence during the 1990s. Gale was up front Monday night when Rivian's R1T pickup rolled out from the darkness at Griffith Observatory in Los Angeles.
But I love the enthusiasm, and you want to get behind somebody that you know has got a reasonable shot at doing this. I mean, nobody in their right mind starts a new auto company in this day and age, but when you stop and think about it, we've been looking for white space where other people aren't, and RJ is just an amazing character at making this happen.
John Shook was there when Rivian first met Normal. He traveled with Scaringe to Normal to scope things out one day in 2016. By then, Mitsubishi had already cleared out. It looked like the plant was going to be sold off for parts. Shook had some experience doing this. He got into the auto business in 1983 through Toyota in Japan. He worked on the joint venture between Toyota and GM called New United Motor Manufacturing, or NUMMI, in California. That was a forerunner to the Diamond Star Motors venture between Mitsubishi and Chrysler that brought that manufacturing plant to Normal in the first place. Shook says he and Scaringe started their day in Uptown Normal, looking around, looking at people's faces to get a sense of the town.
So if we move into a community, we're going to move into a community in a holistic way. We're going to become members there. We don't want to move out. We don't want to leave. So that made it a big decision, more than the dollars that it cost.
Shook says Scaringe was impressed with a 2.5 million square foot plant right away. He tried to stop Scaringe from getting his hopes up, but
by the end of the day, we both knew that we need, Rivian needs this. And we had a sense, without being arrogant about it, that probably the plant needed Rivian, too. It was a shame to see what was about to happen. They couldn't sell the factory, so they were going to auction off all the stuff in it. What was going to happen to that building there? The place is it was a place where thousands of people had worked for many years. It was the source of livelihood. And so to me, that's a very sad thing to see happen.
Seeing the plant come back to life, being recycled in this way, is also meaningful for Tom Gale. He was part of Chrysler when the Diamond Star Motors venture launched.
So it's nice to now see this really come full circle in my lifetime.
So is Rivian going to make it? Will the hundreds of manufacturing jobs come to the Normal manufacturing plant as planned? Will tens of thousands of Rivians be rolling off the production line in a few years? Shook says they're upbeat. It is a launch event, after all.
Worth saying, though, you never know if a business is going to be successful or not. All you can do is set a vision and be determined to do whatever it takes to make it so. But it's wise to recognize that we don't know what the future brings. So when did I know for sure Rivian was going to make it? We're still looking, even today, what's going to happen.
Reporting from Los Angeles, I'm Ryan Denham.
You can follow all our coverage from the LA Auto Show at WGLT.org/Rivian.
Support for GLT comes from Forget-Me-Not Flowers, offering fresh or silk flowers for festive centerpieces, mantel sprays, wreaths, or holiday garlands. All crafted by expert designers and available by calling 829-1001 or by visiting Tawanda Plaza. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, an interview with a Normal Town Council candidate, part of GLT's series of such interviews. Yesterday, GLT's Mary Cullen brought you the story of a young girl who struggled to find a child psychiatrist in McLean County before her mental health woes overtook her. Every path she took led to another wait list. Today, Cullen talks with Bloomington Normal Youth Resources about what they do to support children in mental health crisis.
McLean County has limited access to child psychiatrists. If youth in need are lucky enough to find one, they're often placed on a seemingly endless wait list. Those who aren't so lucky are often referred to a doctor outside of the county, and yes, another wait list. McLean County Center for Human Services Director Tom Barr says there are two reasons for the short supply of youth psychiatrists.
Fewer and fewer physicians are specializing in psychiatry, much less child psychiatry. And this is a nationwide phenomenon. It's not unique to McLean County, and it's not unique to Illinois. What is unique to Illinois is some of the significant cuts that agencies like mine have received, particularly for psychiatric services.
In 2015, the state of Illinois cut psychiatric funding for mental health centers. For CHS, that meant a $350,000 cut. From 2016 to now, Barr says the United Way also cut $100,000 in contributions to the CHS psychiatric program because of fundraising challenges.
Those numbers continue at times to grow. Everyone will acknowledge the lack of psychiatrists and the lack of funding for psychiatric services are a clear need. But at this point in time, the state of Illinois has not been willing to step up and say, we need to provide more ongoing funding to meet this critical need.
CHS provides services for youth over age 12 with mental illness who are either uninsured or insured by Medicaid. But there is a loophole for some youth who don't fit that package. Kim Fryman is the program manager of counseling services at CHS. She says most youth referrals come from McLean County Schools. The County Board of Health provides a fixed grant each year for CHS to see students in need of help and not covered by Medicaid. But they have to be from Bloomington Junior High, Parkside Junior High, or the Olympia School District. Fryman says the grants provide counseling services to any student referred directly by the school as part of a health department pilot program. Teachers and administrators note a recent increase in need for social-emotional services in schools. Tim Moore is the principal at Bloomington High School. He says the school guidance office sends an email to staff when they meet with a student in mental health crisis. He gets at least one of those emails every day.
Our school has seen our district, all schools across the country have seen a huge increase in students that have social-emotional needs, and I really think they're all grasping and trying to figure, okay, so how can we support them even more than what we're doing?
BHS is launching an advisory period, a designated time to help students better connect with teachers and let teachers assist students' social emotional needs.
I gave an example today of a student that is a very loud student. When she's there, you know she's there. We absolutely love this kid. I saw her this morning and she was dead silent. So something's going on with her. And so having that advisory period, if she's in my advisory period, I'll pick up right away that there's something going on with her and will allow me to be able to help her.
That pilot program launches in January. District 87 also uses counselors from CHS and Project Oz. Project Oz provides a mental health education and suicide prevention program at all schools in McLean County. Executive Director Lisa Thompson says the program prepares students to recognize and respond to mental health challenges early by identifying warning signs, practicing coping skills, and asking for help. Thompson says Project Oz also provides youth-empowered schools counselors at Bloomington, Normal Community, and Normal Community West high schools. Unit 5 has those services, but also works to equip teachers to help youths with mental health challenges. Nancy Braun is the district's special education administrator. She says teachers in recent years have become more attuned to troubling behaviors that signal mental health issues. When teachers recognize a kid in crisis, Braun says the school contacts a hotline to determine next steps. PATH, or Providing Access to Help, is a 24/7 hotline, but they don't offer ongoing services. When a youth calls in looking for help, PATH refers them to CHS. As we learned in our first report, local services are not quick to find youth psychiatrists. Braun says that makes finding help for youth in crisis a struggle.
Ready to do a GoFundMe to see who we can bring in, because we bring them in and then they leave because it's so overwhelming. Because there are so many kids.
She says the lack of psychiatrists in McLean County is only getting worse.
So even when we have kids in crisis that have to be hospitalized, they either go to Peoria, Springfield, surrounding counties, because we don't have anything here.
Braun says the need does not stop when a youth is released from care.
So a lot of times our kids who are then hospitalized get evaluated, get on a medication protocol, whatever, and then come back to our community, and there's not a whole lot of follow-through because there's nobody here to do some of those pieces.
Without resources, schools struggle to make up for the dearth of psychiatric care. Unit 5 Superintendent Mark Daniel says when comprehensive care isn't an option, schools have to find a way to help.
quite frankly, if the schools don't try to step in and fill this void, our resources are very limited throughout our community.
Daniel says he knows there are groups in the community coming together to find solutions, but that it's time to see some results.
We're hiring school psychologists, we're hiring social workers, we're hiring interventionists to deal with emotional behavior, so social-emotional learning. And we didn't have to do that 10 years ago. But if public schools don't do it, we'll not serve the needs of our kids, which will then create a deficit to our community.
Psychologists, though, can't prescribe medication. Only psychiatrists can. McLean County's Behavioral Health Coordinating Council, or BHCC, was assembled as a result of the 2015 Mental Health Action Plan. Center for Human Services Executive Director Tom Barr serves on the council. He says addressing youth mental health takes a variety of services.
I don't know of any community, particularly in downstate Illinois, that has all of these services in one location and are able to provide all of these services on an ongoing basis. Many different communities will have bits and pieces of them, as does McLean County at this point in time, for example, with the crisis team. But the goal is to try to bring providers together to coordinate care, and also to help ensure that the families have access to that care.
But the goal isn't just providing those services. Barr says they also have to address the issue of transportation. Barr says that's why school-based programs are so important. They eliminate the need for families to make transportation plans. Barr says the BHCC wants to create more collaborative work between services in the county. He says that way, multiple agencies can utilize the same child psychiatrist. But before there can be action, Barr says there needs to be movement on the state level regarding funds. He says there is no legislation on the table right now that would work to fix the problem.
Whenever there's been a change in state leadership, there is usually some changes in terms of priorities. So we'll have to wait and see. But we want to be very optimistic that additional funds may be available in the future.
With no answers as to when additional funds might be available, those in need of youth psychiatry services have no choice but to wait. I'm Mary Cullen.
Illinois youth in need of immediate mental health care are encouraged to call the PATH hotline at 211.
Support for GLT comes from ESA, Eye Surgical Associates, providing innovative treatment and vision-correcting surgeries for a wide range of eye conditions, including cataracts, macular degeneration, diabetic retinopathy, and glaucoma. You can see the difference at eyesurgicalassociates.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, a story of change, a story of a new job, and a story of culture shock from a Bloomington Normal Story Slam. Business owner Stan Nord says he decided to run for Normal Town Council in part because of how the town offers incentives to help certain types of businesses, particularly those in Uptown, over others. GLT's Eric Stock has more with Stan Nord.
Hadn't been in politics, really didn't pay too much attention to it, but over the past few years, I've gotten to pay attention more and more, and seeing how the town is spending our money and things that they're doing has just kind of upset me. I would get in conversations with other people who were talking about politics, and what I realized was the people I'm talking to, we're talking and there's no action. Nothing's changing. So I'm just wasting energy just talking about politics and what I think the town should do, what I'm not happy with them doing. And I wanted to get in a position where I could actually make a difference and have that energy go somewhere productive and beneficial. My family's got deep roots here. I've got deep roots here. I want this to be a place that when my kids decide they want to raise a family, they want to come back here too.
Can you give me some examples of items that you are not pleased with?
Oh, absolutely. One that I think a lot of folks have a common thread with is these economic incentives that the town is calling them for these Uptown Normal buildings. These Uptown Normal buildings that they're putting in, they're calling these incentives economic development incentives. But what they are doing, they're bringing in buildings which are providing office space, retail space, and luxury apartments that we are subsidizing over a third of the cost. For office space, there is no shortage of office space in this community. This first building that they put up, the only office tenant in there is the town of Normal. The whole first floor is not even utilized. It's not even built out yet. Then the top floors are luxury apartments. $1,700 for a one-bedroom, up to $4,800 for a three-bedroom, and we're subsidizing it. These are luxury apartments. The government should not be subsidizing luxury apartments, and they're calling this economic incentives. The businesses that are coming in are not adding any economic gain to the community.
How so?
Well, it costs us, on the first one, we had about $15 million worth of incentives that we gave. The luxury apartments that are coming in, there's no economic benefit for that. We're giving away all the money for that. We're fully subsidizing luxury apartments for people that can afford, well, $4,800 is the equivalent of a $700,000 house. We should not be subsidizing that. There's no net economic gain there. The town is renting the office space. There's no net economic gain there. There is no retail that's come into that building, so there's no sales tax that's coming from that. This is all being built because of a program that was designed in the late 90s that said we should build the town and have these mid-rise buildings with mixed space, with office, retail, and housing. And it's just not working in this economy. They built this years ago, and it's still vacant. And we're doing another one, yet another one. And the money that they're giving away is directed for our schools. They're giving away property tax. Property taxes are collected and mainly directed to the schools to fund the schools. And they're giving away money that goes to educate our kids for essentially corporate welfare. These businesses have come in and said it is not profitable for us to build these buildings unless the town subsidizes it.
And to clarify, these are property tax rebates, money that they would be foregoing for the benefit of these projects rather than money they are simply writing a check for, just to clarify. There have been some other incentives they've offered for other big projects in the community. Portillo's and Rivian Automotive are a couple that come to mind in recent years. I'd like to get your thoughts on those.
Yes. There are basically two different types of businesses. We've got our economic engine businesses, which are businesses that are here, they hire local, and they bring in most of their money and revenue from out of the area. Those businesses would be like a Mitsubishi Motor, Mitsubishi. You know, Rivian would be one of those. State Farm would be one of those. Firestone, our local universities are those. They hire local and they bring in money from out of the area. Those are businesses that we should be trying to attract. When you have those businesses, they create what I call byproduct businesses. There's all these businesses that come about to support those, whether it's people that make seats for the automotive industry, whether it's people that bend tubes, you know, all these support industries come about to support these economic engine companies. Then you've got all the people that work at these companies. These people need a place to live. So we've got the whole housing market that comes about because of that. The people need groceries. So we've got the whole grocery industry. We've got the people want entertainment. They want a place to go eat. So we've got restaurants, entertainment. All these byproduct businesses are the ones that are here solely because we've got these big economic engines. The town is not focusing their money on attracting these economic engine businesses. They're focusing their money on trying to attract these restaurants, retail. Rivian was not one that the town went out and attracted and brought in. Rivian came because they wanted the internal parts and machinery that Mitsubishi had left. The same with Brandt Industries. Brandt came because of the business that was here. The town did not go out and solicit them. The ones that the town has gone out to solicit are ones that are these byproduct businesses that would not be here without these engine businesses.
We continue on Sound Ideas. I'm Eric Stock with Stan Nord, candidate for Normal Town Council. There are several organizations that work on economic development that the town works with, including BN Advantage and the Bloomington Normal Economic Development Council. The town invests in both of those groups. How effective do you feel they have been in attracting and retaining business?
I am so glad you asked that question. I have met with these groups. I have had my business that I wanted to expand in here have met with these groups. The folks at the McLean County Economic Development Group, they are fantastic. I cannot tout them enough. But what they do is they can tell you based on where your property is at, here are the incentives that are there. If you're in an economic development zones, here's what you get. If you're in a TIF district, then you have to get handed off to the town. That is where things start to break down. There's a disconnect between what the town thinks is a good business and what I guess, really is a good economic driver business. The town looks mainly at retail sales tax dollars. Is this business bringing in retail sales tax dollars? They don't look at it from a point of view as, say, in manufacturing. They don't bring in much retail sales tax dollars because they're building stuff, and the stuff is being sent out elsewhere to be sold. That is a disconnect. The Small Business Development Group over at Wesleyan, fantastic people again as well. They help people fill out paperwork and do things, but then at some point they have to hand it off to the town, and that is where things break down.
As a town council member, should you be elected, how would you work to remedy that in your view?
To remedy it, there's misconceptions. There's assumptions that the town council has, which are not in practice what's going on. I would, as a town councilman, stop assuming that what we think is happening is actually what is happening. I would have direct contact, or make sure somebody on town council has a direct contact with people at each of these groups, that it does not filter and things get lost in the communication chain.
You think that the ball is being dropped at the bureaucratic level then? Or is it a legislative level?
Well, an example might be easy. The town of Normal, or maybe not the town of Normal, but we hear all this advertising about small business. Normal wants to attract small business to the town. We want these businesses because we know that that's going to grow our economy. Yet we have no economic incentive packages for small business. So through my conversations with other economic development groups for moving my business, I found that there were some base economic packages that, say, all of Livingston County has. And I talked with other economic development groups, too, and found out packages that they had. So I go to the town council. Well, actually, I tried to set up a meeting with the mayor. He was out, so I met with the mayor pro temp and sat down with him and showed him all the competition we have, because I don't want to move elsewhere. I want to be here because this is where my family is. But anyway, I was more worried about all the business we're losing and all the competition that's out there. So I showed him these packages. And Livingston County has got a base package for whether you're going to do something new construction or expand an existing business. And I was showing him this stuff, and he said, oh, well, we have that. We've had that for over 10 years. And I was like, well, the folks at the EDC, the county EDC, they don't know about this. The Town of Normal's EDC folks, they don't know about this. They flat out said that there are no programs for small business. But yet you're telling me that there's one? So there's a disconnect, because the town councilman has been here for years, and he just expected that this was a base package that was being used, when in actuality, it was not being used.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Eric Stock with Normal Town Council candidate Stan Nord. What do you think of the proposed multi-sports complex that a consultant presented to Bloomington and Normal as a potential economic engine, but one that would require a significant amount of public investment?
The sports complex, I see other communities that have got sports complexes that have done well. West Peoria, on the west side of Peoria, they've got a baseball sports complex. That is largely done with private funds, and they have made it successful. I believe that Bloomington Normal can do the same thing, but we need to make it something where it is profitable for a for-profit company to come in and invest money in it. We should not be having the taxpayers build this.
If we could talk about a couple of competing projects and priorities the town has on the horizon, but nothing specific at this point. A new library, possibly a library expansion. What do you think of the possibilities there?
Oh, I'm so glad you brought that up. This is a golden opportunity that both towns have. I think it is. In my history of being here, I don't know that we've ever had two projects that both towns want to do at the same time. Bloomington Normal both have libraries that they're both talking about expanding. There's been a change in libraries. Libraries are not just a place where we go to check out books. That's happening less and less. If you talk with the folks at the library, they even say this. They're becoming more of a community center. So if we were to combine resources, both towns are talking about, let's say, for example, building a $20 million library. If we combined resources to build one community center where we had all kinds of activities for the young, seniors, and still supplied books and all these other different things that a community center can offer, if both towns are considering spending, say, $20 million, if we combine resources together and each town say save $5 million, spend $5 million less, and each one spend $15 million. Now we can build a library / community center that is $30 million. That is more, that is a bigger facility than any one town can do at once. We already share services in other places. Our schools cross boundaries, so there's no reason we can't make this work too.
The town council was known for being a pretty cohesive group. How do you think you'd fit into that group, and do you think it needs a bit of new blood and new thinking?
I do think it needs new blood. something that has always puzzled me is that the town council votes unanimously on lots of things, on big issues that divide the town. I don't feel that there's active representation of the town, because if our town is this divided on incentives for uptown normal, but yet the entire council is voting unanimously, then there is a disconnect.
Stan Nord runs a storage company in Bloomington. He's among eight candidates running for one of three at-large seats on the council next spring. Hear other candidate interviews at WGLT.org. Nord spoke with GLT's Eric Stock. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Change produces anxiety and tension. Getting a new job, for instance, and preparing the search and preparing the interview. Change was the theme for a recent evening of storytelling at the McLean County Arts Center. Devin Lovell produces the Next to Normal Story Slams. In this story, we hear what happens when a new teacher from the Chicago area takes an eighth grade language arts job in a small town in Texas. Dave Crostel gives us Welcome to Splendora.
I kind of wanted to tell a little bit about my first job interview and the sort of the circumstances that led up to it and what happened afterwards. If you would have told me, oh my gosh, how many years ago I would have been a teacher, it would have been funny when I was 18 years old. I never, ever imagined being a teacher, first of all. I went to college to be an actor, and that didn't work out. And so they suggested I be a teacher instead, and I thought, well, why not? So I went ahead and got all my credits and all my teaching experiences in college, and in 1984 I graduated. And at that time, too, I had gotten married, and we had a small child, actually an infant, who was born in July, and I was desperate for a job, 1984. And I hated Illinois winters. I didn't really like Illinois that much, you know, but the winters were something that I really despised, and so I'm kind of a warm weather person, so this is not my idea of a good time out here. So I applied to every warm state in the country, California, Arizona, New Mexico, Florida, Texas. I applied to Texas, and didn't hear from anybody, and I was getting kind of desperate. I had a young baby that I needed to take care of. I needed to get a job. And July rolled around, and still nothing. End of July rolled around, and I got, and this was in the age before computers, so you got snail mail if you found out about stuff, or phone calls. And so I got a letter from a township in Texas called Splendora, a very small little town. I think at that time population was about 300 or 350. About 35 miles north of Houston. And they said, we'd like for you to come and get an interview with us. And I thought, okay. It was eighth grade language arts. Now I was a theater major, theater education major. My minor was English, and I thought, well, this is it. This is my job. This is the only thing I can do. I don't know where else I'm going to go. Nothing else seems possible at this time. And they wanted me to fly out there. Now, this time I was 23 years old, had no money, and flying out there seemed a little silly to go out there. Why not just call me on the phone and we can talk about this and, you know, you can figure out. But they wanted me to fly out there. So I went ahead and got the one credit card I had that had a $500 limit on it, got my $350 ticket, and flew out to Houston Hobby Airport and was picked up by a gentleman by the name of Leon Kabilis, who was the, and I love this, the vice principal of Splendora. They were not called assistant principals. So I always imagined he was, you know, carrying a piece or something, you know, vice principal. And he was very nice, super nice, and very warm Texas welcome to me, brought me, you know, drove me from the airport, you know, through Houston. I saw the beautiful city of Houston, and about 35 miles north, we came to Splendora Junior High. And he escorted me in. And he said, Principal Thrall will see you. He'll go. So I went inside. And I sat down in this office, very intimidating, big, huge desk. Price Thrall, I'll never forget his name, was the principal at the time. And behind the desk was him in full uniform. He was a retired brigadier general, if you can imagine that, running a junior high. And nice man, in all seriousness, a very nice man. But before I go any further, I wanted to kind of talk a little bit. I taught psychology for a long time as well, and I wanted to talk a little bit about memory, because these stories that we're telling are a lot about memory and the things that we remember. And I used to teach a unit on memory, and I used to always tell my students, just remember that every time you tell the story, that story changes, and the memory of that story changes. Just a little bit. And my memory of this, although really kind of burned an impression in me, I wonder every time that I tell it if it just is a little bit different, if I embellish a little bit more or leave some things out of it. But I really feel like this one, this particular memory of mine, is pretty solid, because I can visualize almost everything that happened in that meeting. I sat across from him, and at 23, I was so nervous. Interviewing, this is really my, I worked at Kmart before this, okay, that was my big job, you know, and, you know, this was a job that was going to pay me $16,500 a year, which is probably twice the amount of money that I probably was making at Kmart at the time, and I was very nervous, and I, you know, I was just about ready to say anything and do anything to get this job, and so, he began interviewing me and talking to me about my experience, and I told him, well, I have no experience in English. I said, it's my minor. What about junior high? I have no experience in junior high. I taught no junior high classes. All I did was, you know, it was a 6 through 12. And he's like, well, we really need an 8th grade language arts teacher. And so he said, let's get up and let's go in my car, beautiful Cadillac, driving me around Splendora. Splendora, 350. And he was showing me all the different places, you know, the corner grocery store, you know, he showed me nice houses that were for sale, you know, that I could pick up if I wanted to come out, and he was telling me about Hurricane Alicia that had hit there the year before and all the devastation that it had done. And I was just confused. I must have looked very confused. And so I got back to the, we got back to the junior high. I went back into his office, and he said, well, welcome to Splendora. And I was like, I don't want to sound disrespectful, but I spent $350 on a ticket to come down here for a job that I think I was already hired for. And I said, I really didn't have that kind of money. And, you know, couldn't this have been done over the phone? And without missing a beat, he looked at me, and I was just like, it was one of those really weird memories. And he said, well, Mr. Grostel, we wanted to make sure you weren't black. That was my reaction. You can just imagine, in 1984, 23 years old, having a guy, and he must have seen the look on my face. My jaw must have been down to my chest. And he's like, oh, no, not that we have anything against blacks here in Splendora. And I was like, okay. He said, we just don't think someone of color would do very well here, would be accepted here. You see, we have a group. It's not really a formal group here. But it's a group of people who get together. And I said, are you talking about the KKK? He goes, well, we don't call it that. It's not the KKK. You know, these are just guys who get together and talk about white supremacy. So, and you know, 1,000 thoughts are running through my mind at this point. And the memory of that moment sticks with me. And I remember his face, and I just remember him so clearly. And looking at his picture on the wall there, Brigadier General Thrall. And I didn't know what to say. You know, part of me was going, there's no way I'm going to live in your town. There's no way in the world. And the other part of me saying, I got a three-month-old at home, two-month-old at home. I need to have this job. So I said, okay, I guess I'm working for you next year, you know, in the August here. He said, well, we'll get you all set up for it. And I worked there for a year at Splendora. I want to let you know that I don't blame Price Thrall for what was going on in Splendora in 1984. But I only stayed there a year, and I left after that because it was very difficult to be in a town where I knew something like that was going on. I went to a high school after that and did teach theater for 3 years out there and really loved it, my time out there. And Texas was a very nice state, except for some places. Years later, I came back here to Illinois. And this memory was, you know, very clear in my head still, coming back here to Illinois. And I taught at Washington for 28 years. And I used to take students overseas on educational trips. And we, one of the things that kind of sticks in my mind, we went to Germany on one of our trips. And we went to the Dachau concentration camps when we were there. And I began, you know, when we went out there and went around the barracks that were out there and the pictures of the people that were there, our students went from very talkative and excited to very solemn and sincere, you know, when they were there. And the thing that I remember the most going out, because, you know, this was probably about 12 years later, about 1996. Was as you were leaving, I don't know if anyone here has ever been to Dachau, but there is a memorial that's there of, it's a three-dimensional wired memorial of skeleton-like human beings in barbed wire. And underneath that memorial, in about six different languages, are the words, "Never again." And so when I was thinking about this, what Devin was talking about, I was thinking about the situation we find ourselves here in the 21st century and the memories of things that have happened to me in the past in terms of that and what's happening now. It scares me a little bit, to be honest with you. But those thoughts of that memorial at Dachau and what happened to me in Splendora, you know, keep reminding me over and over again that this can never happen again. Thanks.
Dave Krostel telling his story, Welcome to Splendora, part of a Next to Normal Story Slam held at the McLean County Arts Center. There's one there tonight, in fact, as always, produced by Devin Lovell. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. A year before President John F. Kennedy was assassinated in 1963, he made a visit to Springfield, where he stumped for congressional candidates. It appeared everything went as planned, but recently declassified documents mention an incident that seemed to foreshadow what took place in Dallas. During an open vehicle presidential motorcade, a witness saw a rifle pointed at JFK from a second-story downtown Springfield building. The incident has been a mystery for 56 years, and still not all the details are known. Crystal Thomas is a reporter for the Springfield State Journal Register. She wrote an article about it this week and talks with Sean Crawford.
How did you find out that there was something that occurred during that motorcade?
Well, so on the 55th anniversary of President John F. Kennedy's actual assassination, which was last week, the Washington Post ran an article by Professor Stephen Knott. This professor actually got these declassified documents from the John F. Kennedy Library in Boston that explain this incident. He was the one who found that this incident actually happened. We didn't know about it for so many years because it was sitting in that document that was still classified until 2 years ago.
And your newspaper at the time just had a brief blurb that something had occurred.
Well, I wouldn't even call it a blurb because it was two lines on page 7. It was part of, it wasn't even part of the main story. It was part of a story called Kennedy Sidelights that was explaining kind of the police presence it took to protect President Kennedy and to secure the motorcade. And the two lines didn't talk about how there was a rifle pointing at President Kennedy at one point in the motorcade. All it said was that two youths were arrested and that they were held for Secret Service. There was no follow-up and no explanation for why they were arrested.
So talk about this rifle itself, and somebody, of course, witnessed this. Do we know who saw it, and what did they say? What did they describe seeing, and of course, what did the investigation turn up?
All we know about this incident so far is what was found in that biweekly report that was declassified 2 years ago. The report is about... it's about 20 pages, but the brief about the motorcade is about a paragraph. And what it says is that there were two young men. They were in a second story floor of a building somewhere downtown. And as the motorcade passed by that building, once it left, an Illinois Department of Public Safety employee saw a rifle and a scope sticking out the window. And from there on, local police went and got the two youths, arrested them, and brought them to Secret Service. They were questioned by Secret Service. They admitted that they did stick the rifle out the window at the presidential motorcade. But their explanation for doing so was that they wanted to see if they can see the president through the scope of the rifle so that when he came back through the motorcade 30 minutes later, they could see him better. They weren't prosecuted. They were, however, their rifle and the ammunition was seized.
So there was never any follow-up that we could tell. No information was given by the police or the Secret Service to the local media.
Not to the local media. And it's pretty curious because I couldn't find anything in any of the Illinois State Journal's pages following the incident. There also isn't a trace of it in Springfield lore, which is what I kind of find the most interesting part, because there were locals who were involved in that arrest. There were police, there were sheriff's deputies, things like that. Maybe people who are on that motorcade route that saw something. And yet somehow this incident didn't trickle down.
Crystal Thomas is a reporter for the State Journal Register. She says she tracked down one of the youth involved in that incident. He did not want to talk. Thomas spoke with IPR's Sean Crawford. Illinois' 200th birthday is Monday. Illinois is a major state nowadays, but there was a time when statehood was far from certain. For this week's Illinois Issues, Tara McClellan McAndrews reports on how that all changed with a bit of deception. IPR Sean Crawford has more.
Tara, let's go back 200 years. I doubt most people today can comprehend that there would even be a doubt as to whether Illinois would be ready to be a state, but it was a much different place than what we know today.
It was a much different place. A little bit more than 200 years ago, we were a territory. We weren't a state, of course. And frankly, we were a bit of a backland. We were the Wild West. Illinois really became a state when it did because of one young, ambitious man named Daniel Pope Cook. He went to D.C. to seek a patronage job and was unsuccessful. And when he came back, kind of all of a sudden, he decides we need to be a state. Well, being a state means that there will be more opportunity for everyone, presumably him included.
So you focus on Daniel Cook. You also focus on Nathaniel Pope, a relative of his.
Daniel was Nathaniel's nephew. Nathaniel Pope was the Illinois Territory congressional rep who could not vote at that time because we were a territory. And Nathaniel Pope, as one historian told me, basically kind of gets this letter in the mail saying, hey, we decided we want to become a state. And so he just takes it under his wing, makes that his cause, done. And they get it done pretty darn fast.
Well, slavery was still an issue in Illinois. A lot of people don't think of Illinois as a slave state, but back at that time, there were slaves living in Illinois.
Absolutely. And it was legal. And one of the problems in our territory becoming a state was that the law that ruled admission to the Union as a state, the Northwest Ordinance, forbid slavery. So what we had to do was tread a very fine line. We wanted to keep the settlers here, many who came from the South and had brought their slaves and were pro-slavery. We wanted to keep them here. We wanted to get more people here. How do we do that? How do we appease those folks and still toe the line with Northwest Ordinance, which forbids slavery? And we did that by framing our first state's constitution, which basically enabled both. The new state's constitution basically said, we will not allow future slavery, but the existing slaves can stay. It was a bit of wordplay, if you will, that opened the door for what became slavery in Illinois by another name, indentured servitude.
That's Tara McClellan McAndrew speaking with NPR's Sean Crawford. Monday is Illinois' 200th birthday. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. WGLT.org is where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Ryan Denham, Eric Stock, and Mary Cullen. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.